Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to WithInsightsRadio.com on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Your free online holistic publication resource radio for trusting your intuition, achieving self-discovery, and following your soul self.
Hey, good evening. This is Dr. Landis, Cloud Piler to many of you. I am the Tech to Ectim to the Namenha, and I am the lead on this radio program tonight. Chief Wellamuck and my son Jonathan will be here directly. He's working with a supplicant right now. We're here right here in our offices, which are part of the Pathway to Healing in Springfield, Missouri. I want to give some appropriate gratitude to our wonderful host, Ignacio Garcia, and With Insights Radio. It's really helping us a lot to be able to sit down and have conversations about some of the things that we do and believe and some of our practices in the Namenha and some of the ways that we're trying to make a difference out there in the way that we're teaching our ministers to behave themselves as well. It's all in behavior. You look at a lot of illnesses, whether we're talking about the human body or animal bodies or plant bodies, illnesses of the land, illnesses of community, society, nations. It is so much tied to what we do, what we feel like we need to do, what our motivations are that lead us to ask questions, which should lead us, I should say, to ask questions about what we're, you know, what the problems are today. I'm going to talk, I would really like to talk about one of those issues. We haven't spent a lot of time on this topic, and I want to thank one of my students, Suzanne Roberts, for bringing this to my attention today, and she's really correct. We've talked about nutrition, we've talked about natural healing, we've talked about herbs and supplements and energies and all kinds of different modalities that are used in natural healing. And we do focus on apothecary. We focus on the medicine that's in plants because, you know, we have focused anyway because that's part of what we do. We are compounding apothecaries ourselves, and we deal with a lot of issues with the healing of the body that are specifically addressed in the way we practice with sacraments that are based in the healing attributes, the mechanisms of action in plants, and how our body responds to that. But I would like to talk about nutrition. Suzanne brought to my attention, rightly so, that we have not spoken enough. We have not highlighted enough the key element of healing that nutrition plays, you know, the function in healing that nutrition plays. It just simply cannot be overemphasized. There's no way to do it. And I think one of the things that got me thinking about it, besides Suzanne, was got a telephone call with regard to and scheduled an assessment with a very ill person. That'll be happening soon. And I got to thinking about what I know without even meeting her, knowing what I know about her condition, what I know she's going to have to commit to if she is to overcome it and come back into a margin of a balance that will bring her back into health. And I got to thinking and contemplating what a disproportionate degree her entire protocol will rely upon, in which her entire protocol will rely upon nutrition and what she decides to do nutritionally. And then I started thinking about how general that is. We talk about there being quite a few things that really compromise most people's health. In other words, no matter what specific disease is the problem, very often we find that the underlying issues are really based in just a few things that if we can control and bring into balance those very few things, the body has an inherent ability to heal itself. And relying upon that, enhancing that inherent ability, is really what natural healing is all about. Part of that, part and parcel to that inherent ability to heal, is providing the body with the tools that it needs to heal. And that can only be done either by supplementation, which is really overdone nowadays, or in nutrition. So one aspect of nutrition I really want to talk about, what I really want to dwell upon, is how we can, without having to check into some center somewhere, we can at home provide for ourselves the kind of nutritional change, nutritional behavioral change that can bring about healing. And use some examples of how that's happened. Years and years and years ago, I was finally diagnosed with a horrific end game disease. Now, I had suffered quite a long time with, first of all, with a devastating infection, intestinal infection with the bubonic plague, and damage was done to my digestive tract, and from there it developed into Crohn's colitis, and you know, it went on and got worse and worse. And finally, I was starting to have some problems throwing kidney stones, and so I ended up being involved with a urologist. And he, you know, even though it wasn't his specialty, my GI issues, he felt like my GI specialist simply wasn't doing the job and getting down to what was actually going on. And he went out on a limb and he took a look where the GI specialist avoided the issue. And when he did, what he discovered was that the Crohn's colitis was visibly no longer Crohn's colitis, but had developed into full-blown cancer of the bowel. That began my journey toward natural medicine in a real substantive way. And of course, I cut my teeth on internal medicine, natural internal medicine. And that's something I really focus on to this day. It is essentially my specialty. But I look back at those days, and I wasn't a naturopathic doctor. I had no real background except stories that my mother had told about her mother, being a midwife up in the Teton Mountain area of Idaho and Wyoming. And so, you know, I was going from a completely allopathic foundation, a consumerist allopathic foundation, one that absolutely relied upon the good job and the good insurance and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And having discovered categorically that I had the bad one, that this was the game changer, the end game, so to speak, I had to turn around and find the guts to face it and then to do something about it. Not simply wait to be acted upon, but to act in a way that hopefully would allow me to see my children grow up. And so I found myself in an unemployable state, unemployed and unemployable, no money, absolutely relying upon those around me who loved me and my family, and, you know, without any hope. In fact, when it came right down to it, I was told that there was probably 6 to maybe 8 weeks left. And when I did talk to an oncologist and asked him what he would do, he told me, it was very abrupt, and told me that what he would do is he would get a good prostitute and head to the Bahamas, because that's about how much time he figured I had left. There really was no treatment. So they sent me home, and this is a common story. We hear this story a lot. When you sit around and talk to people who have gotten into natural medicine, you kind of hear these sorts of stories. Most of them have a healing experience of their own to talk about, and I'm no different. I went to my Native American roots and contacted a man who had helped me with a vision quest many years earlier, and essentially told him, hey, the white witch doctors have had their day and their prognosis is bad. What can the red witch doctor do for me? And he guided me to some immunomodulating herbs that mushrooms and herbs that are available in the Northwest where I lived. But that is not the only thing that I did. That's the demonstrative thing. That's the herb that helped to get me well and form the basis of my protocol in terms of herbal medicine. But just as important to that discussion was what I had to do nutritionally. Now, as I said, I was unemployed and unemployable. And I had planted a great big garden, which, as often happens in Washington State, the garden had gone to weeds. And we had a huge garden full of broadleaf weeds. And I went out in the garden in my despondent, depressed condition, you know, little children and cancer and hopelessness, and I went down on my hands and my knees and I began to graze like a cow would graze in my garden. And this, I bring this to mind every time I get to thinking about it, because I think about the immune modulation that I engaged in, really rigid, really aggressive immune modulation, and that really helped bring my cancer around. But I also engaged in a lot of a different eating, dietary behaviors. And the biggest difference was all of a sudden I added to my diet dark green and other colored leafy vegetables and even weeds, a whole lot of weeds. Because there's not a lot of difference between vegetables and weeds so long as you're not eating the weeds that are poisonous.
It would have looked something like that nasty kale salad you made me eat.
Oh, that salad was fantastic.
No, it was
today.
Pretty good. It was,
but there again, you know, kale was a weed. Mm-hmm. And not too long ago, not too many generations ago, kale wasn't eaten by humans. Kale was a plant that grew along the seashore in Northern Europe. And you know, was then hybridized and changed by man, manipulated into becoming a food.
Right, yeah.
And that nutritionally was an absolute godsend to me. Welcome back, by the way. Thanks for popping in. You know, feel a little bit lost sitting here all by myself, and I get used to there being two people here in the room. So I have to say that adding, after growing up with meat and potatoes, pretty much fat and starch and salt diet, sad diet, actually, pretty much growing up that way and feeling like it was my cultural responsibility to eat the way my parents and my grandparents had eaten.
The diet upon which the West was won.
Yes, the faith of our fathers, right? I changed that. I had to change that because there was no way to afford to buy any other food. We were literally feeding our children on the worst possible food because it was the cheapest food. And I went out and literally grazed in the weedy garden, eating both weed and food plant. And I used some supplements too that were local grown sorts of things to modulate the immune system. And that was the protocol that got me over the hump. That was the protocol that saved my life from that devastating disease. I go into this thinking, with a high degree of reminiscence, okay, I focus my attention now as an internist on
internal
medicine. Yeah, I'm a naturopathic internist.
You're not an internist.
I'm not an internist.
You're an internalist.
I'm an internalist. What's an internist? Is that did I make up a word?
Intern.
A frequent intern? Okay. Internal medicine is my thing. So, but I still have to reflect on so much of that protocol was nutrition, and every single bit of that nutrition was not something that I could buy at any store, not at a health food store, not a grocery store, not from any manufacturer, not from any wholesale distributor. None of what I used, absolutely zero percentage of what I used to address that horrifying disease came from any purchase whatsoever. And it it behooves us now and then to realize that not only does our body have intrinsic ability to heal, but our environment has a vested interest in our success. Now, we human beings, we place ourselves above the environment. Take a little swallow of water. We place ourselves at the top of the food chain. We place ourselves at the top of the intellectual food chain and the ecological food chain and the economic food chain. We have placed ourselves at the top of everything. And in so doing it, we tend to isolate ourselves from nature. But nature actually has a vested interest in our success. And if we seriously look around nature and observe what is really there, what she is giving us, almost as a mother would give food to her child, you know, and we look at the greatest successes in degenerative and devastating disease, you know, it should not surprise us with the body's intrinsic ability to heal that it is tied absolutely to the environment's ability to provide the materials we need to enhance that intrinsic ability. So from there, I want to absolutely state that, you know, I have some very opinionated opinions about the kind of organism that human beings are. Okay, as far as from where I stand, studying the teeth, studying the digestive tract, studying the form and function of our body and our anatomy and our physiology, human beings are not graniferous.
No. No.
We do not have the capacity, the natural born capacity to eat, to process with our own tooth and nail, and to process with our gut, and to digest with our systems. We do not have the capacity to eat most of the grains that we call food today. We are not graniferous. And yet, I know that at certain times, you know, a human being would probably anciently have gone out and eaten seeds.
Mm-hmm.
But in the field, we don't go out and eat hard rock wheat, for example.
No.
What if you found yourself, disembarking from a raft from the Mediterranean, walking up into the steppes of the Middle East, and you needed some food, and there was the grasses growing on the steppes, which we now call wheat,
mm-hmm.
At what point would you call that food? Would you eat the stems or the blades or the stalks of
no,
the wheat?
No.
Would you eat the kernel dried as hard as rock?
Not if I needed a meal right then. Uh-uh.
No, you would find a meal right then by stripping the husk and finding
the soft
cheese form of the seed. And you could eat that, and you would be perfectly able to digest that, eat enough of it to have a meal.
That would be considered ripe grain as opposed to the hard seasoned grain.
Yeah, you walk up to an apricot tree and you would not pull a green fruit off of the tree and eat it.
No.
In all likelihood, you're going to throw up. You're not going to come in after the tree has lost all of its fruits and the moldering, you know, windfalls are half eaten by the. You could eat those, but you're probably not going to. There's some fermentation that's happening, and you might probably just fall asleep after eating not enough to have a meal because there's that much alcohol in an apricot that has fallen on the ground late in autumn, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there are times and there are seasons for all things under heaven, and the time to eat grain is in the season thereof. And the season thereof is not necessarily when the miller has made it right for you in the fall to make bread, right? So naturally, I'm going to stand on my hind legs like a good human, and I'm going to admit that human beings are opportunistic omnivores, not graniferous, not strict herbivores either.
No, that much is clear.
I mean, we can't eat grass in any form. we can eat certain of the broad leaf plants because they're more digestible, but we still lose a great deal of that in fiber. So the plants, yes, we can eat as food, but there are the plants that have literally taken over the world are the most predominant, and therefore the herbivores have really adapted to eat those because they're most abundant. That's what the herbivore would do over time, would adapt to eat the most abundant and prevalent food. We can't eat that most abundant and prevalent food.
We got to eat the seed when it's ripe.
We eat the seed, the fruits, the soft leaves, some of the roots. Very opportunistic as an herb, as an omnivore. We also eat bugs. I've been around the world and I've eaten some of those delicious insects and grubs. I mean, much more delicious than the tapioca at the Chinese buffet, you know, that I've been to. Much more delicious. Animal matter, you know, meat and birds and small animals that we could catch and so on and so forth. So
collagen from bones.
Bone, yep. Cartilage, joint.
Broth has probably got to be one of the most ancient forms of food we have on record.
Exactly. We do have record of what was food anciently. There's no question about it. So we know that we are opportunistic omnivores. And human beings have hybridized food, plants, and animals for time immemorial for their own purposes. But purpose, motive, has to be looked at, you know, in justifying the hybridization. To decide whether, for me to decide anyway, whether I'm going to put that in my mouth or not, or whether it would be wise or mindful to put it in my mouth. Because I'm frail, and I have my favorite things, and sometimes those things are things that I probably should not even consider food at any level.
But the Danish is so good.
I've already admitted this, but human beings in general, when I'm working with my own health and helping other people with their own health, what I find is if we will step back to being to where we can think of ourselves and our history, our biological history, get into the fact that we are really opportunistic omnivores, then whole avenues of treatment, whole avenues of protocols open up that were simply not available to people who grew up in the standard American diet.
Yeah.
And it is exactly the same as me when I went back and I got on my hands and knees and I crawled through the garden just eating as I went. That became part of a treatment protocol that saw me to survival. That was a long time ago, and that cancer was a devastating thing. And I see that in people who overcome really serious disease. When we get right down to it, we find that the nutritional, the dietary issues behind recovery are not fat diets by any stretch. It's not don't eat carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. It's not don't eat fat. It's not don't eat protein. It's not do eat carbohydrates. It's not do eat fat. And it's not do eat protein. It's eat right for the kind of organism that you are. Okay, we bring animals and we put them in zoos, for example. Gorillas in zoos. For the longest time, I remember seeing at feeding time, we'd stick around at the zoo, you know, in Seattle, the Woodland Park Zoo, and we'd watch them feed the gorillas. And they'd take these big boxes of lettuce, iceberg lettuce, and they'd throw them in there and they'd eat them. And they'd eat them, and I kept reading about how the gorillas were sick, and they were going to lose, please donate money, we're going to lose the gorillas at Woodland Park, and
donate money so they could buy more lettuce?
Yeah, and I got, you know, it never occurred to me back then that maybe, just maybe, gorillas don't eat lettuce. The idea was the gorillas were herbivores. They were
primarily,
it was just fruits. They were fruitivores, and they were herbivores.
That doesn't make any sense, because they were observed to eat monkeys.
Not at that point.
Oh, no.
Not then, no.
Okay, that was later.
What was discovered, however, that all of the large primates will eat insects, they'll eat lizards, they'll catch fish, small fish in shallow streams. They'll eat birds, mm-hmm. they'll eat small mammals, they'll eat monkeys. You know, that they, when they happen upon the opportunity, they will take animal protein. And when they added that to the diet in the zoos, the gorillas at Woodland Park Zoo stopped getting so sick all the time. They were no longer constantly in danger of losing their gorillas. Eat right for the kind of organism that you are. And if you will eat right diversely, excuse me, and also obey certain dietary rules, such as don't eat what is not food, right? Take your omnivore diet, a good diverse diet full of the right kinds of foods, mostly plant, real mm-hmm. plant food, and not too much, and resist, oh please resist, I beg of you, the temptation to add bad fat.
Aww.
Yeah, meat that has been from animals that have been raised in ways that they're not genetically adapted to.
Or meat waste products.
Meat waste
from food
products, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And the plethora of bad fats, I go back to that, but there's just so many bad fats to eat. Avoid the temptation to go to food, to reach for food because it's cheap, not because it's actually food. Avoid that temptation. Eat real food, food that is mostly plant, but not necessarily all. Remembering that we have an absolute need for animal-type proteins and fats. And, you know, do right by your own organism. You're going to give your body all of the elements it needs, all of the basic structural and nutritional elements it needs to utilize its own intrinsic healing ability and bring you out of that dark night of despair, dark night of the soul and of the body. It's going to bring you out of it because you have the mindfulness to eat what is real and set aside what is garbage. And in the topic of garbage, and I said it just a few minutes ago, mankind has been hybridizing and manipulating the genes of animals and plants for time immemorial. And I'm not going to argue about the genetics of any of that.
No.
I'm not really smart enough, and frankly, I don't care. You know, whether I'm eating a white rabbit or a black rabbit, it doesn't matter to me. If I'm eating a rabbit, let me eat a rabbit. But I am interested in eating a rabbit that doesn't have fish genes spliced into it so it can live underwater. Okay, that's an exaggeration, right?
I don't think they've managed to do that successfully yet.
No, not successfully. But we do have tomatoes that have sea squirt genes in them.
That's true.
So that they can live longer into the cold season.
Mm-hmm. They grow better in cold hydroponic systems.
And they have an antifreeze in them, just like the sea squirt does, mm-hmm. so that you get well into the winter before you have to shut the program down. I take exception to that, kind of genetic manipulation, genetically engineered food, because I'm here to tell you, there's no day in the week where I'm going to look at a tomato that has genes of some sea squirt, some crustacean in the ocean spliced in, and not be a little bit hinky about that. Now, go further, and we ought to be looking at what motivates somebody to change the tomato so intrinsically. Because that tomato that has the sea squirt or the mouse gene spliced into it, or the bug, or whatever they're doing, they take a virus and they carry a certain gene trait from a totally unrelated species,
mm-hmm.
and they allow that virus to carry that into the genes of the target organism. In most cases, that target organism then becomes not fit or unable to bring forth fruit of its own. In other words, it's unable to reproduce.
Right.
That strikes me as dishonorable. Now, I'm not going to argue the genes.
That's a good description of it, though.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue the genetics of it. My ancestors predicted a time when mankind would commit the ultimate atrocity upon nature, and that was to organize or to orchestrate, engineer organisms for their own convenience that did not have the ability any longer to reproduce, to take away the endowment of the mother and the endowment of the father and make it so that the organism itself is unable to reproduce is considered in the beliefs of my ancestors an absolute atrocity. And that is where we are.
Yeah.
I was speaking with a good friend of ours in Puerto Rico, and he was lamenting how the big seed companies like Cargill and Monsanto, or not necessarily seed companies, but the GMO companies that came into their country, their island, and used their island as a chemical waste dump and a laboratory to experiment, along with the pharmaceutical industry, and use the population to experiment on. He was lamenting the fact that they were leaving the island like rats from a sinking ship, dumping all their employees out on the street and just simply lock, stock, and barrel leaving. And it was after literally removing just about all of the natural food plants from the island. So that here's a man who's, okay, got 2,000 acres and I want to plant it. I want to do it organically. I want to go back the way my ancestors grew food. And he's got to go to the United States to buy seeds because there is nowhere in Puerto Rico where he can buy an open pollinated tomato or an open pollinated cucumber or an open pollinated anything.
Oh, no.
And when he decided that he was going to do this thing, he got threats from his neighbors. He was threatened by his neighbors. Yeah, because if you plant those, they're going to cross with our Monsanto, our Monsatan plants, and where you know you're going to ruin our GMO. You're going to disturb our ability to make a living with these plants that we're growing. And he's threatened with lawsuits. So didn't go forward with lawsuits because I don't know how they could. But they did also say don't let us ever discover that any of our patented seed plants have found their way onto your property or into your seed bank, because we will sue you and we will get the income from that. You have to at some point come down to the motivation. Why? Why put the genes of a mouse or genes of a lizard or genes of some insect into a tomato?
Structural integrity.
Tomatoes are perfectly sound as vegetables.
Not when they're picked unripe.
When they're picked unripe, they're more sound than they are when they're ripe. It's not structural integrity. In the case of the sea squirt, for example, it's so that they can be grown in a season when they're not normally grown.
And some vegetables are modified so they survive in the refrigerator trucks longer. They can travel further.
Antifreeze in the vegetable. So what you're telling me, what you're agreeing with me is that there is no nutritional reason to change that food.
Oh, no. No, no, no. That would suggest that most of our food is grown here in the United States.
It's not.
No. In order for food to travel, it has to survive the journey. In order for it to make any profit, huge quantities of it have to survive the trip.
Right.
You can't do that with a local growing supply.
No.
You have to modify the plants, just like manufacturers have to cut corners when they're making supplements.
That's right. That's right. In our area, there was a movement toward the range or the grass-fed range chicken egg. And instead of building these great big huge factory farms with the chickens, they were building smaller operations that allow the chickens to get out onto the field,
mm-hmm.
and they train the chickens to go quite a distance from the hen house, from the egg house, to get any food at all. So it's not just a matter of opening a door and they go out on a little 10 by 10 patio and they're range eggs, right? Free range eggs. No, it's not that at all. It's that these chickens went out there and they got insects and they got weeds and they got a diversity of plant life, and they also got feed that was organic, and they go back into the hen house and they lay eggs, and those eggs are processed as usual and go to the grocery store. And it was a big deal. There were lots of them doing it. Well, interestingly, when we went to Walmart, you start seeing eggs, the price of eggs come down to 59 cents, 69 cents a dozen.
Insanely low.
Insanely low.
Yeah.
Half the price of what it takes to actually feed that egg. Where is that egg coming from? Certainly not coming, of course it's not range fed. It's not
no.
a free range.
No. It's factory farmed eggs.
Factory farmed eggs cost too much in America to sell at 69 cents.
That's come from overseas.
They're coming from China. And what happened was our President Obama at the time loosened up some trade agreements that allowed huge numbers of eggs to be transported from Asia, of all places, where there is absolutely no control on quality or what can be fed or what, you know, what can be sprayed and no control whatsoever, and subsidized it at the same time so the prices could come down. Why? You have to think of why that. I mean, it's amazing how many chicken farms in the United States, and I'm not talking the organic ones. I'm not talking free range.
No, we're talking...
How many of those went out of business?
Chicken farms?
They went absolutely out of business.
Oh, a huge percentage of them.
Why, as a government, would you orchestrate such a program that would put your own people out of business in deference to eggs coming out of China? I mean, you know...
It doesn't make any logical sense, so I can't answer.
It does not make any logical sense, except that...
It doesn't even make as much money.
It doesn't. It doesn't make anybody as much. It costs the American people because it's subsidized. So here we have a situation that does nothing more than destroy a certain amount of what is locally produced so that we rely more and more on food from the global market.
Yeah, yeah.
Globalization is everything, even when it comes down to the egg. And our organic free-range production facilities could not even afford to raise their chickens, and they gave them to their neighbors. You could literally go and take I know of people who backed up with moving vans and horse trailers and loaded thousands of chickens and just drove away with free-range egg-producing chickens. We have a next-door neighbor who has a great chicken operation in our neighborhood, has marvelous free-range eggs, but where he got his eggs was from one of these operations that was absolutely unable to go on producing that year because of an agreement with China over eggs. That it speaks to motivation. And so when I come down to the genetics of GMO, for example, I look at motivation.
Right.
What is the motivation in producing soy plants, for example, that can carry three times as much Roundup as other soy plants?
Better yield? Less die-off?
Roundup's an herbivore.
Yeah.
It means that you can actually use more Roundup when it's time to harvest than you could before.
I'm going to be sick.
Ah. So when you eat that soy, and it's not just soy.
No, they do it with a lot of grains.
Right. Corn, soy, wheat.
Yeah.
I mean, just about all of them. When you are using Roundup to limit the competition in the field so that you're not, so that all of the nutrient material in the soil is going into the plant that you choose.
Yeah.
You are mining the soil.
Yeah, because the GMO with the Roundup, the GMO herbicidal additives to the plants, just means that the herbicides that they spray don't kill the target plant. They
right.
kill everything else.
The Roundup doesn't kill the corn because
right.
the corn is Roundup resistant because of the Roundup that they have genetically engineered into the body of the corn.
The corn ends up using the Roundup, incorporating the Roundup in some of its cellular structure.
Right. And so here, this begs the question. Human beings are just as adaptive as corn. When we eat that corn and we take into ourselves the Roundup and the Roundup-enhanced genes, all we do is break that down into carbohydrate, right?
Sure.
Wrong. Roundup has never, ever been food for man.
No.
It's not allowed to be sprayed on food. You can't take corn on the cob at Wood's grocery store, take it out into the driveway or out into the parking lot.
I'd like that served with Roundup.
Yeah, you can't take that out in the parking lot, spray it with Roundup, take it back in the store and sell it as food, can you?
No.
You may not. It is recognized and understood to be a deadly poison to man, and yet they can take that corn with Roundup in it and sell it to you as food. That speaks to me only of profit.
Yep.
The only reason for doing it is profit. And when that corn cannot reproduce, you know, you can only get it from Monsanto, and it's heavily GMO'd for Roundup, and Roundup is known to absolutely disrupt the body's ability to use carbohydrate, and it's also known
yep.
to do so many other bad things. Brain function oriented, especially. We have something that affects the human organism on so many negative planes, negatively on so many levels, that it is absolutely an atrocity. This would be an atrocity to spray over a city,
uh-huh.
over a school ground full of children. It would be an atrocity. It would be terrorism to spray this on a group of people waiting for their bus to go to work. You'd go to jail for the rest of your life. They would ship you to Cuba, to Guantanamo, and you would never see the light of day. But we are required to eat this stuff in all of our food.
It's all benzene washed. Come on. There's no Roundup in it.
It's in the cellular structure, though. So many of our plants that make up prepared food has this in its
yeah.
structure. Something that would get you convicted or sent without even a trial to live the rest of your life in a prisoner's camp on an island somewhere is ubiquitous in all of our food. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And so I will sit with a desperately ill person and I will talk about protocol.
Mm-hmm.
What can I do? How can I change my diet? What can I add to my... What protocol do I need to solve this problem? And my mind is brought back to, where can I send this person to get food that doesn't have Roundup in it or that isn't genetically modified to resist the effects of Roundup so that there can be more Roundup sprayed on them, so much so that it can't be taken off the plant and you end up eating it?
The next question is, how big is their wallet?
How much can they afford? And how sure am I that when I send them to my local health food store that they're even getting food that doesn't have Roundup in it? I mean, you know, there's a lot of nations in the world have said no to GMO,
mm-hmm.
but God forbid that God-fearing Americans can pull their head out of their asses long enough to demand that our food be safe.
That's what the FDA is for.
Oh, we have the FDA for that. And the FDA has proven to be our advocate, proven to be our white knight, proven to be our savior and our God. But They're not. The FDA doesn't give rats behind. Calm down.
PG-13 at least.
When it comes to GMO, I'm not going to argue the genetics. Again, I don't care. Hmm. Two things have to be understood by Americans before we will, I think, ever get a grip, reel this cancer problem back, reel this brain function problem back, this crisis in American culture. Two things have to be addressed. One, if there's going to be genetic engineering of food, it needs to be to enhance the value and quality of the nutritional value,
yes,
and quality of the food.
That's what our ancestors did.
That I have no qualms with, mm-hmm, so long as you don't produce a Frankenstein that cannot reproduce itself. Those are the issues.
Mm-hmm.
That's that. Let's continue mindfully, intelligently, adapting foods and adapting with foods, because change is part of the human experience. No problem there. But make sure that the nutritional quality of the food is enhanced without destroying the life of the plant or the life of the soil where the plants are grown. Two, we have got to grow the courage to demand that our handlers stop engineering the things they want us to regard as food with chemicals that are without question deadly to us and everybody and every damn thing on the planet. Because that is where we are. We sit and we watch swords being rattled against shields right now, and the issue is nuclear.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have nuclear bombs again. We're going to have the nuclear cold war and the nuclear winter. And it's a very real threat. It's a very real fear. But at the same time, we are committing a social atrocity, the likes of which has never been committed in the history of the human experience. In the First World War, we can read about, you know, mustard gas and nerve gas and the horror of it, and we just shudder. We think, oh, how awful. I'm so glad we live when we live. And then the Second World War comes the nuclear age, radiation. And, you know, that's all solved for a while. We thought we were out of the woods, and the Iron Curtain comes down. Oh, thank God we live when we live. What a blessed time. What a blessed people are. How worthy are we? And then we find out that we're right back in it, and we're listening to, you know, saber rattling from our own great,
yeah,
our own great orange leader, Wichlap, and other leaders around the world, you know, whoever this rocket man guy is. And yet we Americans turn our faces and ignore that we have demanded, through our demand for convenience and our demand for cheap and our demand for surplus and growth at all costs, we have created the most horrible, most horrifying human atrocity in human history. Not only have we murdered all over the world countless millions of people through the Green Revolution, but we have destroyed the soil, and we have robbed whole species, whole cell lines of plants of the ability to reproduce. You know, I was reading an old account of, well, it's a book that I love. He talks about getting into his great aunt's attic and finding a list that she had made of the plants, of the fruits and the vegetables that they took to the county fair. And she would make long lists of the different names of the different types that they grew. And he had a photograph in one of them. And it wasn't just a little 10 by 10 display like you see of my farm grew these squashes this year and it's all in this beautiful display. And yay, and you got a little blue ribbon. Yay, squashes. Yeah. It was a display that was 60 feet long and had everything. And this was just a little, you know, a little family farm. And she listed the names of the different types of corn and the different types of beans and the types of squashes and the this and the that. And he said it was a huge list with hundreds and hundreds of different names, all grown on their farm. Where do you suppose they got the seeds for that?
Their grandparents?
They traded.
Yep.
There weren't, you know, you could buy some seeds from seed companies, and they were popular. And seed companies have been around for a long, long time. But I'll tell you what, every farm was its own seed bank.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did was he went and he tried to research where to get those today.
Good luck.
And they're gone. Even the ones that she bought from seed companies then are gone.
Yeah.
We have systematically, through the Green Revolution, wiped out tens of thousands of different kinds of food plants that human beings worked for thousands of years to develop for different climate, for different situations, different sun, different soil. Thousands of years of development for the sake of the profit of one or two or three companies, we have wiped out thousands of different types of food plants, all for the sake of growth, economic growth, the economic growth at all costs of two or three companies. It is absolutely, you know, it's absolutely Nazi. It's not Rocket Man. It's absolutely Hitler. We're talking about Auschwitz on a plant scale here, you know. And so, again, I'm not going to argue the genetics of GMO. Is it a good genetic policy? Is it a bad genetic policy? Two things make it a bad policy in my mind. When plants that are fobbed off on human beings as food are developed for the sake of the bottom line and not for the nutritional value, that is assault. It's assault, and it's assault with a deadly weapon.
Yeah.
Because those plants will kill you and are killing us by the tens of thousands, by the hundreds of thousands, by the millions every year. It is atrocious. And two, when a plant is genetically engineered for the sake of the sale, the sales volume of a specific or a group of deadly poisonous chemicals.
Yeah.
To bolster and enhance the bottom line of a satanic company or industry. Absolutely satanic. And I'm not thinking of Satan as Lucifer or Satan as the great human bugaboo. I'm talking about the absolute, not the axis of evil, but the axis, the spokes, the hub, the wheel, the wagon, the whole highway of evil.
That's why we call him Mon Satan.
Mon Satan. I've sat with scientists and argued genetics. Hey, listen, you know, before I was ever a naturopath, I was, you know, I started out wanting a degree in ranch management. And so herd improvement through genetics was a big part of that education.
Right,
trust.
Yeah.
And I know genetics. I love to mess with colors and pigeons and fish. And it's just fascinating, okay? Improve the production in a mushroom crop and, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, this is not a genetic, this is not an argument in genetics where there's anybody but a winner when you're doing things that way. But when you start robbing a plant or an animal with their ability to reproduce. There's only one reason for doing that.
It's to keep control of the supply.
It's to keep control of the supply so that you may only buy your seeds from one place.
Yep.
Well, what would be the purpose if competition is a spice of life? If competition is the grist of the American economic mill, why? I mean, you know, we have laws against that kind of thing when it comes to telephone.
Sort of.
You know, the antitrust laws caused Microsoft to break itself up. You know? But not when it comes to corn, by God. You've got to buy your corn from one place. You know, you go into Africa, and one of the greatest lamentations for a lot of small villages was, well, we got incentives and we got money to move into Western-type agriculture, but then we found we were only allowed to buy our seed by contract because mm-hmm. we needed the money to change the way we did things and to
yeah.
progress and move into the modern world. Because they gave us money, they got to control where we bought our seed. And I have read reports of where farmers have decided to go back to open pollinated seed, and then they lost their farms because they had to repay the loans that they had received that they thought were grants. And the government came in and took their farms away from them because they planted corn. But really not because they planted corn, it was because they planted the wrong corn. Mm-hmm. They planted corn that could actually reproduce, that they could actually harvest seed and plant again the next year, and they lost their farms because of it. That is not the same as herding people into a gas chamber and burning them to death. But it's close.
Yeah.
It's real close. When we're looking at, you know, the number one killer in America is still heart disease, and then everybody in America is going to be diabetic,
mm-hmm.
and now Alzheimer's is diabetes 3,
mm-hmm.
and just about everybody's going to have cancer in their lifetime, or know somebody close to them who dies of cancer in their lifetime. When we're looking at these kinds of changes, when we're looking at a populace, well, let me just use an interesting example. Back when the Winter Olympics were going to be in Utah, there was some terrorist threats,
mm-hmm.
or some rumors of terrorist threats. And we were lucky at that time to have a mole in our organization who was pretty high up. He was an administrative executive in the Utah Pharmacy Association. And so we got a report from a training that he went to that outlined how pharmacists were to handle things should there be a terrorist attack on Salt Lake.
Oh, that would be interesting.
And one of the things that he told us was, and this is a sign of the times, I think,
mm-hmm.
Understanding now what Roundup does to brain function and brain development, that issue alone, among all the other things that Roundup does to our body, it is now believed by many to be part of the reason that we can't eat grains anymore, and part of the reason that so many people have to be on head meds. But they were told, those pharmacies were told to close their doors
mm-hmm.
and not go to work, because one of the things that would become in a terrorist attack, those people who are on head meds were going to be the ones that mobbed the pharmacies because of the uncertainty of whether they would get their head meds.
Not the terrorists.
Not the terrorists at all. It was the general populace. And I looked at that and said, oh, that can't be true. That can't be true, right? So I went to the South Jordan School District, and I talked with the school administrator at the South Jordan School District. Now, in that school district, they do year-round school,
mm-hmm.
and they do day and night shift because they don't want to build more schools.
Right.
But they have too many kids, so they have to put them somewhere, but they don't want to build more schools. You know, schools are expensive.
Of course.
It's not good use of funds, but we got to have them in school.
And I asked them what percentage of the teachers were on head meds. And he said, I can't really give you that number, but I can give you this number. More than a majority of eighth graders are on Prozac or one of its analogs. And he says, and I can give you this statistic as well. More than a majority of third graders are on Prozac or one of its analogs.
You guys took me out of school in third grade.
In third grade, that's right, in Idaho. More than a majority, and I found out from another source outside the school administration at South Jordan from one of the teachers, more than a majority were on head meds. Of the teachers were on head meds, antidepressant drugs, anti-anxiety drugs, more than a majority of teachers in that school district. And I have to tell you about an experience that was relayed to me. It's about a work group that went from a prison out to a school to do some painting, some stripping and painting of doors, a work release program. And the gentleman was telling me how he went, and there was a hoorah-rah. A couple of the young inmates broke into the teacher's lounge and found the kids' head meds in a cabinet, and they broke in and they got them because they sell them as contraband in any prison, you know.
Yep.
It's all about making money. But the interesting part of the story was the follow-up, that they thought they were stealing from the cabinet that had the students' head meds, but when it came right down to it, they were actually stealing from the cabinet right next to it. They were both locked cabinets.
Yeah.
The cabinet right next to it had all the teachers' head meds.
Oh, my gosh.
And they stole a lot of head meds. And this is a little backwater high school, you know, up in Clearwater, Idaho, with a student body of maybe 40 seniors, you know. Not a big high school. Can you imagine what it must be like in California, where there are thousands of students and hundreds and hundreds of teachers in a high school, where a high school is a small city, bigger than any of them that I would want to live in, and it's in the high school. Well, no wonder there have to be armed guards and metal detectors in the schools. I mean, when I went to school, I never saw a security officer with a gun in high school. In junior high school, a security officer with a gun, and you get off the bus and you come through a big chain link fence and you pass through a metal detector to make sure you don't have a dangerous weapon on you for the safety of the teachers. I mean, that is a symptom, a social, a cultural symptom that at some point needs to be looked at. What is so different now than 50 years ago, and I'll tell you one thing that is a common denominator in all schools, a basic common denominator, and that's what you look for.
Yeah.
Common denominators. The basic common denominator today that was absolutely absent 50 years ago is psychotropic drugs. I was told by a drug salesman from South Africa had moved over to Utah when we lived in, and you remember the story. I think you were there when he told it to us.
Yeah.
He listened to one of my lectures, and afterwards we had a little talk with a few people after the lecture, and he told us about being a drug salesman, a pharmaceutical salesman in South Africa, and he'd moved to Utah, retired, moved to Utah, and he said, "Do you know, I sold a lot of Sandy Candy." What we call Sandy Candy, and on the form where the pharmacist would buy it, it was called Sandy Candy. On the purchase order. I said, what are you talking about? What's Sandy Candy? And he said, it's really interesting. See, the meeting was in Sandy, Utah.
Uh-huh.
And I had told about the school, you know, there in South Jordan, which is the town right, you know, it's a suburb right next door to Sandy, which is a suburb of Salt Lake. And he said, yeah, I sold a whole lot of Sandy Candy. And I said, what the world is Sandy Candy? What are you talking about? And he said, it's Prozac. I said, well, why is it called Sandy Candy in South Africa? And he said, well, it's because when we were selling it in South Africa, we used the high schools in Sandy as our example.
Oh, no.
And he said at that time, and this was only like 3 years earlier, more Prozac was sold to students and teachers and parents in Sandy, Utah, than anywhere else in the world. And so the nickname for the drug became, and the code, the purchase code there
Sandy Candy.
Was Sandy Candy.
Gosh.
And it was because of its use in the schools.
Uh-huh.
Prozac in the schools. That is now being connected, clearly connected, to what's in our food. And so at a certain point, we have to stand back and say, it's at a certain point, Americans are going to have to vote with their pocketbooks, vote with their stomachs, buy food that is food again, and demand food that is food, and call to accountability those who give us poison and call it food, and get away with it, and get away with it by law.
That's the big rub right there.
It is. I mean, how do you feel as a father about these companies that are allowed to produce food for your children?
Oh, I'm mortified. My kids describe the food that they ate that day, and I'm speechless. They go to school. We put our kids in the hands of government.
Mm-hmm. And we have to, by law.
Institution, we have to. And what they get to eat is pig swill.
Absolute garbage. Absolute garbage.
I would never feed them that food at home.
Well, even the food at home, when we take an honest look at it, we're not perfect.
No,
we take an honest
not.
Look at it, and we are failing as natural practitioners. We eat. I mean, we fail in our own protocols that we give people to get well. I mean, we're as numb to this as anybody else. The whole of the American population is numb to the fact that our food is now no longer just bad for us because it's processed. It's no longer good food. We are numb to the fact that that so much of processed food is absolutely poisonous.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely poisonous. Mm-hmm. We have in our bodies a biome,
mm-hmm.
a huge, massive amount, number of species that live in and on our bodies that must maintain an equilibrium for us to be healthy. Otherwise, one gains ascendancy like MRSA or something like, you know, Streptococcus or Staphylococcus or what have you,
mm-hmm.
and we get terribly sick. We know this.
Yeah.
This is abundantly proven. I'm not going to argue that either. But if what we're eating destroys or puts out of balance our biome, our internal biome, how is that not the same thing as swallowing something that is deadly? Or if what we're selling to others puts out of balance, so terribly puts out of balance the internal biome that it destroys our ability to even digest food on any level,
mm-hmm.
how is that different than pointing a gun at someone's face and pulling the trigger?
I would not consider it different.
It is exactly the same. It is atrocious. It is atrocious. So now we sit back and we watch hurricanes that are coming through, and I believe me, I feel awful for those horrible victims.
Yeah.
Puerto Rico right now, you know, there's going to be horrible want and disease and starvation and atrocities because of nature, because of this storm. But we as a people have the capacity and the ability to send them food relief. But you know what we're sending them in terms of food relief?
Industrialized food products.
Yeah, you might as well send them paint and tell them to eat it. We might as well send them paint thinner and tell them to drink it for all the good that it's going to do. It's not just that it's not going to be nutritious for them. It is that it is poison. So now, in your extremity, in your crisis, in a time when you poor people are more stressed and more in fight or flight,
than ever in your lives. Not that the last 10 years haven't been bad enough. We're going to send you our worst possible excuse for nutrition.
Because it's cheap. And we can send a lot of it.
Because it's cheap and we can send you a lot of it. We can send it by air. We can send it by boat. We can send it by camel. I don't care. Well, to Puerto Rico, probably not.
Not
but,
a camel, probably.
You know, it's going to be a lot, and it's going to be nothing that you should put in your mouths. There will not be safe food sent anywhere. Do you think that the relief that went to Texas was actually safe food? I look at the food that was stored by so many preppers in you know, in preparation for Y2K. You were too little, but I remember that. Oh,
I remember
my goodness. You know, we got some of that. Somebody gave us a whole bunch of that food, and it was in gallon cans.
Yeah.
Dehydrated food in gallon
well,
cans.
Well, people were doing the same thing in 2012.
Yeah, for 2012. But I remember because we got a whole bunch of it. We got a basement full of this stuff. We take our can opener and open up a gallon can of dehydrated potatoes. We open it up, and there's 1 inch of dehydrated potatoes in the bottom of that gallon can. And that, I guarantee you, is the kind of thing that we're sending in relief. A whole bunch of air, rice, wheat, sugar, powdered milk,
years
and beans.
And years old.
Yes.
Stored in a warehouse.
Yep.
Pulverized into whatever convenient powder it can possibly be stored in.
Yep. I'll never forget in high school, way back in the day, we were in class, in a class of American, U.S. government, which is required as a senior in high school when I was a kid. We're sitting there in that class, and my teacher came in, and in those days, we didn't have internet. I'm that old. He comes in with a VHS, a video recording.
What's it the look?
The military had government, but we didn't, which tells you it has not been, I mean, the changes that have happened are huge. Brings in a big hunk and VHS machine with a big, huge monitor on a cart, rolls it all in, and he puts in this VHS that had been filmed by, you know, a military reservist who was in Somalia, delivering relief to the starving children. And he had a video camera, and they unloaded the pallets and pallets and pallets of boxes and barrels, and he recorded what was actually given to those children on video. And I just, you know, here I'm a 17-year-old senior, and, you know, I just put my hands in my head, my face in my hands, and bawled right there in class. And half the class was the same way. Half the class didn't care. But what he videoed and what we saw as a part of our U.S. government class was United States military relief, Air Force Reserve or Army Reserve or National Guard or whatever the hell they were, opening boxes of cornflakes, Kellogg's cornflakes, pouring them in a bowl, and then pouring in Coca-Cola. Cornflakes and Coca-Cola was the American relief in terms of food to those starving children. And they handed it to mothers who then went and fed this gruel to their children. That has stuck with me forever because that is a beautiful example of what we now have in our grocery stores. It doesn't have to be Somalia. Doesn't have to be Africa. Doesn't have to be Central America, South America. Doesn't have to be Puerto Rico after a hurricane. That is what we are feeding Americans now. It's fancy looking. It has fancy labels. It has fancy names.
How many children get up in the morning and eat a bowl of cornflakes with ultra-pasteurized processed milk and a soda or sweet tea?
In the morning.
First thing in the morning.
Then they go on the way to school, if they're walking, which is not very many of them, and they'll stop and they'll get a soda.
Yep.
And then when they get to school, in a lot of places in America, soda with
their lunch.
Yep.
Now, in a lot of places, especially in junior elementary to junior high school, the soda machines have been taken out, and soda's no longer allowed. But how long did it take? This is 2017, for crying out loud. When you look at the high fructose corn syrup and the fructose corn syrup that is in...
And the crystallized fructose.
And the what did I just say? The high fructose corn syrup, once you put some water back into it, or some spit or what have you, you're looking at one drink. How do I describe this? I described this to in class today. Take a bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly, not quickly, take some cane sugar, white cane sugar, and a teaspoon, and put 30 or so teaspoons of cane sugar in a bowl. Fill up a glass of water and pour those 30, so that you have a good visual. This is something, this is an exercise I think every single American should do. Every single American should take a bowl and put, I'm a little emotional about this, measure out 28 teaspoons of white cane sugar, the devil. When you have got a visual of what that 28 teaspoons looks like, that's a lot.
Yeah.
In a bowl. Fill up a little glass of 12 or so ounces of warm water. You want to be warm so that, you know, the whole thing mixes. And then pour that sugar into that 12 to 16 ounces of warm water. Do this. Stir it around until as much of it as you can possibly get to dissolve has dissolved, so that you have a saturated solution of sugar. And then drink it. I defy anybody to do this, but drink that. And when you're all done, because a lot of that sugar will still be at the bottom of the glass, take that spoon and eat that wet sugar. Get it all down. Swallow it all. This is the test. And here's the reason for the test. The average soda has an equivalent, when you take that high fructose corn syrup and you make an equivalent in white sugar, the average soda has anywhere from 20 to 60 teaspoons in equivalent of sugar in one serving. That is what we are feeding Americans. And that high fructose corn syrup comes from corn. And that corn is Monsanto or Cargill. And it is heavily either GMO'd to take a lot of Roundup, or it simply has a lot of Roundup on it. So think about that the next time you sit down and open that, you know, Dr. Pepper or whatever, and take a swig. Think of the 28 to 60 teaspoons of sugar that you are drinking every single time you drink that 12 to 16 ounces of soda.
Oh, but see, I'm okay. I prefer Coke, personally. But I drink Diet Coke.
Oh, well, okay. I'm not going to argue the genetics, okay? I'm not going to argue any of the genetics. But I think that's an exercise that every single American, when we are talking about nutrition, every single American should do that, because the soda is actually symbolic of all the food that we eat. All the processed foods is an analog of soda. That's why we have the rule, two rules in the Sacred Sahaptan Healing Way. And they're very simple rules when it comes to diet, when it comes to nutrition. The first one, generally to everybody, is an easy one, right? Eat real food. The general idea is to eat a diversity of foods.
Mm-hmm.
And fad diets do not provide, by any means, a diversity of food.
Which is why I ate that nasty kale salad.
Because it was really
it was actually really good.
There was a ton of stuff in that.
That wasn't just kale.
That had probably 40 different things
in it.
It
had three kinds of fruit, and it had several nuts and a couple of
legumes.
It was really good.
It was actually, it had sprouts, had quinoa, had all kinds of cool stuff in it. It's a diverse food, real food, know that what you're eating is food.
Mm-hmm.
Make it mostly plant. And to my mind, I'm not talking about grains as plants. Grains are grains. Grains are a specific part of a plant.
Mm-hmm.
Make your food mostly plant. And I'm not saying all plant. When you eat meat and fats and animal products, make sure you know that they're real, know where they came from,
mm-hmm.
and kind of know how they were raised. Make sure that you're eating the good fat, that you're eating the good protein meats. Make sure that you're eating safe and sound food. And then don't eat too much. So, real food, mostly plant, not too much.
A rule of three. We like rules of three.
The rule of three. Now, the next rule is a little harder. This is the one where I say this in class and I get a whole bunch of people who make faces at me. Either a deer in the headlight face or I'm never going to do this, try and get compliance out of me. You can name that face anything you want to. But this is the rule. Anything in a bag, anything in a box, anything in a bottle, anything in a can, you must read the label before you put it in your mouth. And if you can't, explain the nutritional value or purpose of every ingredient in that bag, bottle, box, bag, box, bottle, or can. It is not to be considered food. Now, I've heard people ask, like Daniel did, in the Bible, in the Old Testament, he says, my Lord, what will be the end of these things after he'd seen the destruction of the world? You hear a lot of people saying, how can we change this? How can we possibly see a change? How can we possibly, what can we do as individuals to change any of this? It's not going to be the government that changes this.
It's going to be buying power.
It's not going to be the farmers Mm-mm. who get smart and provide real food for us. They will provide what we demand of them and only.
Yep.
What the corporate farming, corporate agriculture will only provide what the market demands. And I'll tell you what, us eaters are the least of their market. We're not the ones doing the demanding, right?
Oh.
It's not going to be the farmers. It's not going to be the gardeners either. They're going to be providing food for themselves for the most part. We, the consumers, must begin to vote with our pocketbooks. We must demand food that is real. That's why I say we're going to have to at some point, just to be honest and a little more than blunt, we're going to at some point, every single one of us, including myself and including you, including Mercola, including everybody who touts fad this and fad that, in addition to those of us who are actually providing sound natural medicine services, all the rest of the crackpots out there and all of their clients are going to have to unifiedly demand, or we're going to have to unifiedly, in a moment of profound enlightenment, pull our heads out of our asses, right? And demand real food again. We have to do it. And if we don't, if we decide, what would cause, what would prevail upon us? What would prevent us? What could possibly prevent us from achieving this lofty goal?
Money. It's organic food, the good for your food, for most people that we speak to. It simply costs too much, costs more than their wallets will bear.
Yeah, there's the elephant in the room, right?
It's because it's an exotic item in the market. Good food, the organic food, the fresh food is so exotic in the American marketplace.
So it's unrealistic.
And it gets bumped way up there, 300-400 times above standard retail value.
If the only way that we could, with our pocketbooks, demand a change is to not buy food. So what I want you to do is not buy food. I want you to go hungry.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, that's going to do it,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
That's going to happen. America, Dr. Landis, great chief cloud piler, is saying, go hungry. Don't buy food.
Well, I could probably use a little bit of that.
You and
maybe.
I have some surplus to work on, but a lot of people don't. And frankly, that's just crackpot, isn't it? That's crackpot language. That's not going to happen.
No.
But that is the kind of crisis that would cause manufacturers to mindfully change the nature of food. But that is not going to happen. So how can we do this?
We do this incrementally.
Or there is another way. Rather than saying vote with your pocketbook, pull your smartphone out. Google the manufacturer, get a phone number, I don't care who you call, and talk to someone. Pull yourself out of your social media and actually find a live body and tell them that you want real food. Do this every day. Now, if I could get 10% of the American population to pull their, not their heads out of a dark place, but their phones out of their pocket.
Yeah.
Get off your damn social media, which does absolutely nothing, and actually use your phone to call a manufacturer. You can Google them. You can get phone numbers. Call them up.
Mm-hmm.
Wait the few minutes that it will take to get to some representative somewhere, and then read them the Riot Act. Demand it. Okay, for a month or two, that's not going to do anything. But I guarantee, as the manufacturers, as these companies begin to receive hundreds of thousands and millions of phone calls, there will be no more need to vote with our pocketbook, because we're going to be able to go right down to the grocery store and we will see shelf after shelf after shelf of real food again, because there's money in it.
That's what it says.
There's money in it. They will make money by pleasing the displeased. Do I hold out any hope? Actually,
yeah,
I kind of do. We can actually do this thing.
Yeah.
Get on the telephone. Use the telephone for more than just false activism, empty activism, the paper tiger that it gives you, just a consumer item, another gadget to ruin, so you have to buy another one. Get on that device and use it for what it is best for, to speak your mind, to tell the source, to tell the manufacturer what you want as the buyer. That is a whole lot better way to vote with your pocketbook than to not buy food.
Because you're already paying for that phone.
Well, and you got to eat.
Yeah.
So use the phone for what it is best for. I challenge every one of us. I do this myself quite regularly. I don't know if I'm the only one doing this, but I know that just by the math, it would have an incredible impact. I thank you for spending a little time with us. Thank you, Jonathan, for joining me.
Yeah, thank you.
And this again is Chief Cloud Piler here with Chief Willa Mutkin. Please walk sacred, talk sacred, and we'll talk to you again next week.